Thank you, Jason, for that gracious introduction. It's an honor to be addressing this gathering at which so many very important and historic conversations have taken place, and it's also an honor to be having this discussion with Brad Watson, a man of great courage, as some of you may know if you've been following his academic journey from St. Vincent to Hillsdale. So in America, most right-leaning intellectuals espouse some form of classical liberalism, a theory that stresses free markets, individual rights, and the inviolability of private property. The more libertarian defenders of this theory stress its individualistic aspects, while the more traditional seek to reconcile it with faith and family. As ingenious and coherent as the various defenses of it may be, classical liberalism has ceased to correspond to reality. It is not so much wrong as obsolete. When classical liberalism first attained prominence, its key ideas supported and were supported by distinctive forms of economic and social organization. Classical liberalism was the theory. Bourgeois individualism was the practice. Business structures such as the partnership, the family firm, and individual entrepreneurship translated the liberal stress on individualism and property rights into economic reality. Something similar occurred in the domestic sphere, where the nuclear family promoted hard work, thrift, and mobility. Childbearing was accepted only within marriage, and marriage required the creation of a new economically independent household. A broad social consensus encouraged industry and thrift. Young people had to labor and save before they could cohabit or have children. The nuclear family also allowed its members to be more mobile and independent than they would have been in a multi-generational household or extended clan. Classical liberalism also drew strength from the country's dissenting Protestant sects. America's Puritan settlers, Methodist circuit riders, and Baptist revivalists all shared a mistrust of religious authority and a concomitant reliance on private judgment. This Protestant suspicion of clerices was not limited to the private religious sphere. It fed into politics, where it became perhaps the most powerful support for the individualistic and small government ideology that still finds a home on the right. Likewise, a religiously motivated stress on sobriety, frugality, and hard work formed citizens who conformed to the classical liberal ideal of the enterprising, independent man. For more than a century, the social forms that supported classical liberalism have been in decline. The most precise description of the change is proffered by James Burnham and other writers on the managerial revolution, which has overthrown the bourgeois order just as the bourgeois revolutions overthrew the ancient regime. As businesses grew, ownership was separated from management, and the middle class came to be defined less by the owner-operator than by the wage-earning professional. Today, an upper-middle-class person is far less likely to own his own farm, firm, or factory than to receive a salary. As Joseph Schumpeter observed, this process is a normal element of capitalist development. He wrote, "The perfectly bureaucratized giant industrial unit not only ousts the smaller, medium-sized firm and expropriates its owners, but in the end it also ousts the entrepreneur and expropriates the bourgeoisie as a class. When this happens, property becomes dematerialized. It still exists as a formal legal category, but it loses much of its substance and meaning. This weakens belief in classical liberal conceits, such as the inviolability of private property." Schumpeter has a passage describing this very well. As he says, substituting a mere parcel of shares for the walls and the machines in a factory takes the life out of the idea of property. It loosens the grip that was once so strong, the grip in the sense of the legal right and the actual ability to do as one pleases with one's own. The grip also in the sense that the holder of the title loses the will to fight economically, physically, politically for his factory and his control over it, to die if necessary on its steps. I think even of Henry Clay Frick when he was shot by an anarchist after suppressing a labor strike with Pinkertons, he made a point of sending off several telegrams and dictating letters before leaving the office. That's the old hard bourgeois spirit right there. A spirit that has been receding for quite some time. Along with economic changes, there have been cultural ones. 40% of Americans are now born to single mothers rather than into nuclear families. Protestantism has lost the predominance it once enjoyed in American culture, weakened by waves of Catholic and more recently non-Christian immigrants, the fundamentalist modernist crisis, the decline of the mainline, and the rise of the nuns. Yuying Shi, a Chinese-American historian, has described modern Confucianism as a wandering soul adrift from its body, a philosophy torn from its traditional institutions, the temples, academies, and imperial examinations that once gave Confucianism concrete form. The ghost of classical liberalism is likewise without a home. The modern conservative movement has launched nonprofits devoted to hymning the profit motive. It has raised up genteel scholars who praise hard-nosed businessmen. It has given young people a vision of life they cannot realize because its material basis has disappeared. This is why so many bright young conservatives end up not starting businesses, joining family firms, or gaining tenured professorships, but writing grant applications, managing endowments, and organizing conferences. Integralism is only one of the terms now used by people who seek to move beyond classical liberalism. Integralism holds that politics should take into account man's final end, which is union with God. It is distinct from, but has arisen in response to the same circumstances as, Christian nationalism. Dan McCarthy, in his brilliant address last night, aptly described these movements as Constantinian. They have risen not just in response to broader economic transformations, but in response to important political events. In Iraq, a noble desire to spread human liberty led to a tragic increase in tyranny. As elections gave way to ISIS and fingers dipped in purple gave way to streets drenched in blood. For some, this disaster called into question the American right's commitment to liberty. Likewise, the US's failures in Iraq seemed to call into question the right's small government instincts. Donald Rumsfeld, an accomplished businessman, brought the same cost-cutting and efficiency-finding instincts to the Pentagon that he had deployed at large corporations. But the so-called Rumsfeld Doctrine, which insisted on a modest commitment of ground forces, backfired. The same was true of de-bathification. This attempt to reform a country by purging its corrupt civil service should raise profound questions about the current conservative goal of retiring all government employees. Domestic events have likewise called into question classical liberal conceits. When the Obama administration first projected rainbow colors onto the White House walls, it was not just celebrating the Supreme Court's recognition of gay marriage. It was announcing that an older order, symbolized by the stars and stripes, had given way to a new one that marched under the rainbow banner. This regime rejects neutrality. Religious freedom, due process, and equal treatment before the law must all yield before the imperative of inclusion. If the expression of certain views makes members of protected groups uncomfortable, those views must be silenced. If legal norms cause an insufficient number of cases of sexual harassment or rape to result in conviction, the norms must be abandoned. Christianity famously introduced a distinction between the sacred and secular realm, differentiating the things that belong to God from those that belong to Caesar. The new American regime has collapsed this distinction, creating a system in which full citizenship is closely tied to right belief. On the right, the success of gay marriage has caused many to ask what the conservative movement is capable of conserving. The conservative movement has been characterized by its simultaneous commitment to moral traditionalism, laissez-faire economics, and liberal principles of argument. But after Obergefell, the business interests that conservatives had defended turned against the convictions of religious Americans. Likewise, the conservative belief in the importance of free speech and of transacting public business in the currency of reason and argument came to seem naive beside the cancellation tactics employed by the left. Perhaps an unstinting defense of corporate power is not finally conservative in its effects. Perhaps America, whatever it claims to be, is hardly a liberal democracy. These dark reflections have led some in unexpected directions. A radicalization of the left has prompted a radicalization of the right. It is in this context that one must understand the rise of integralism. Its theses, often phrased in the starkest terms, seem unlikely to gain universal acceptance. But even those who find little to like in the theory would be well advised to take its emergence seriously. Its rise is a sign of the weakness of conservatives' received philosophies. It is an indication that new thinking is needed on the right. Its rise is perhaps best seen as an attempt to revive political thinking by raising again classical questions concerning the best regime. In 1970, Irving Kristol surveyed the decline of provincial American life and its bourgeois form of republican morality. He did not suppose that the past could be revived, but he hoped that we might arrive at a set of values and a conception of democracy that can function as the equivalent of the old bourgeois morality. Of necessity, this new American ethic will be less bourgeois and individualist than classical liberalism. It is unlikely to conform to any one creed, but it will almost certainly differ from the left in proposing a more authoritative place for religion in public life and in defending the goodness of our political community. For the American right will cease to exist when it no longer stands for faith, flag, and family. Thank you.